For more than 3,300 years, the Jewish people have preserved and transmitted their wisdom about how to live life. From generation to generation, parents taught their children, teachers taught their students, in a living chain that stretches back to the giving of that great wisdom in the Sinai Desert. Perhaps never has there been a generation more desperately in need of this ancient wisdom. A wisdom today made available to the English-speaking world by scholars like Lawrence Kellerman. Sit back and enjoy while Lawrence Kellerman takes you on an adventure into the world of ancient wisdom for modern minds.
When I arrived in Jerusalem, the traditional community there was foreign to me. I had never really experienced them, although they're all traditional communities like the one in Jerusalem, scattered around the United States and other places in the world. I had never experienced them. When I first began to experience them, I saw much of value in their community, but, to be honest, I saw many things which were bizarre, and I kept the list. Now, I think that anybody who is coming from where I came from, a UCLA Harvard-educated individual, when they first encounter the tradition of Jewry, there's going to be things that seem very strange. And I won't go through my whole list with you tonight, everything that I found strange in that community. It's irrelevant to the topic we're discussing tonight, which is the lost art of love. But there are a few things on the list which are worth discussing. I'll raise those right now. For example, when you first encounter the traditional community, you find a group of people that are very impassioned and very devoted to their service of God. Having said that, their obsession with, and I think obsession is not the wrong word, and I hope you don't find what I'm saying offensive, but their obsession with detail is over the top, incomprehensible from a rational perspective. I remember when I first heard that these very traditional Jews, they put on their right shoe before their left shoe every morning. But of course, you tie your left shoe before your right shoe, unless you're a woman, in which case you tie your right shoe before your left shoe. I remember when I first heard that, by me, the Sabbath, I grew up in a traditional home. And when I say traditional home, my home was a right-wing conservative home. In our home, we had something of Shabbat. We had a concept of the Sabbath. So on the Sabbath we rested. I remember my father didn't go to work on Saturday and said, these people on the Sabbath, they feel that if you flip on a light switch, then you've done an offense to the Sabbath. The obsession with detail is far out. When they sit down to eat their dinner on Friday night, if you pull the peas away from the corn instead of the corn away from the peas, that's a violation of the Sabbath. The level of obsession with detail is over the top, incomprehensible. Many of the things that I admired about their community were carried to such extreme in terms of detail that, again, it became incomprehensible to me. I remember when I first learned about the laws of kashrut. So the laws of kashrut are actually a very beautiful thing. And the way that Jews traditionally kill animals is one of the only painless procedures for killing animals known to mankind. Unless you're going to use drugs, it seems that shchita, which is this very traditional system, is extraordinarily effective at reducing the pain of the animal. The knife has to be so incredibly sharp that there is not a single nick. It's sharper than any surgical instrument. If there's a single nick in the knife, these traditional Jews take the animal that they just killed and they give it over to non-Jews because they're not allowed to eat it. Because, God forbid, the animal might have felt some pain as the knife is dragged across the animal's neck. If the person who's slaughtering the animal stops partially way through the stroke with the knife, for a moment stops and then continues again, the animal might have felt that, could have caused a moment of needless pain to the animal is not kosher by their standards. Problem number one that I have with the traditional community, and forgive me for listing off these problems, I do it with deep respect, they are obsessed with detail. Problem number two, I entered into one of their institutions, one of these places called Yeshiva, and I won't say that I studied there. I sat in on studies. For me, it was a very exciting sociological immersion. What I used to do was, I didn't pray, but I would arrive in their yeshiva at like 9 o'clock in the morning when they were done with their prayers, and I would stay then from 9 o'clock till about 1 o'clock studying. I remember I called it the Talmud, yes? And, you know, these great 2,000-year-old texts. And at 1 o'clock, they prayed again. Now, I felt it was offensive for me to walk out at that point, because I was already in the building. To come late, okay, no one notices. But to walk out at 1 o'clock, that's already offensive. So I didn't leave when they prayed. What I would do is, I would grab a hold of one of the Jewish prayer books, and I would open it up, and I would stand there reading the Jewish prayer book while they were praying. And the truth is, at that time, the Art Scroll prayer book had just come out, and I remember thinking there were all sorts of very interesting things in the Art Scroll, so I was more than sufficiently entertained while they were doing their prayers, and I would sit and read this book. About 3 months into my stay at the first yeshiva I ever encountered, right after this afternoon prayer, a fellow walked up to me, one of the guys, one of the young men who was learning this yeshiva, and he says to me, Kellerman, you don't pray right. I said, excuse me. Well, you know, what did you have in mind? So he says, I saw when you're praying, you're just sitting there with the book open, your eyes are scanning the book, but your mouth's not moving. So I intuitively had a sense of where he was going, but I couldn't believe it. So I said, what do you want me to do? So he says, you have to say the words. So I said, what do you mean? So he says, when you pray, you have to speak. You have to say the words out loud. You can't just think it in your head. So I couldn't believe he actually went there. And I said to him, wait, are you telling me that your God doesn't know what's going on in my heart? And if I think the prayers, it doesn't count? So he had absolutely no training in Jewish outreach whatsoever, which is beautiful because he was so disingenuous. He was so, you know, he was completely honest with me. And he said, yes, you have to say the words or nothing ever happened. Yeah? Right? So I said to him, that's paganism. At which point he probably didn't know what the word meant, but he got very flustered. Yeah, and he ran over to a bookshelf and he pulled off this massive folio-sized book and opened it up and started gesticulating and pointing at the book and screaming at me, you have to say the words, you have to say the words. At which point three or four other yeshiva guys realized that he was in over way over his head, and they came and grabbed him and dragged him off. So, the first thing that bothered me was why someone's tail. The second thing that bothered me was why do you have to say the words? Yeah, it's such a crazy thing. Their God doesn't know what's in my heart. It's bizarre. Third thing that bothered me, I have a long list, but I only go through three tonight. Third thing that bothered me was like this. There were a number of very talented, very insightful people who were working for this particular yeshiva that I stumbled into. And there was one guy in particular who was extraordinarily articulate. So everybody wanted his time. And it was hard to get access to this guy. What I used to do was I used to go every morning at breakfast time and sit with him. And I would sit and eat breakfast with him because no one was around and I could pummel him with my questions. And then after breakfast, I would disappear while they prayed until 9 o'clock I would show up again. And all my questions basically had the same format. My questions were, Rabbi, why do we have to do this? Why do we have to do that? How can you justify this? Isn't this a violation of the best of Renaissance values? And in every case, for about 3 months, this rabbi served up the most spectacular intellectual feast. Each time I would ask one of these sorts of questions, he would give me, I mean, we're talking deep response. I was impressed. Until one morning, I don't even know what the question was I asked him, but I must have hit a nerve. And this rabbi, after I asked my question, he looked down, and he sort of smirked, and then he looked up at me, and he said, Kellerman, you keep asking the wrong question. So my antenna went up immediately, and I was immediately suspicious, and I said, what do you mean? And he said, you keep asking, why do we do this, why do we do that? Don't you know, he said, that our theme song, our mantra is, and he quoted this Hebrew phrase, Ma'aseh b'nishma. We do it, he said, even if we don't understand it. So what bothered me was not so much that if you scratch behind, right, this the surface of this traditional Jew, that you found a religious fanatic. That didn't bother me. I think I all along expected that even the most articulate members of this community probably were religious fanatics. What bothered me was that this man was a sensitive person, and he seemed to understand who I was. And yet, he said to this UCLA Harvard educated student, "We do it even if we don't understand it," and he said that proudly, as if that would be something that I could appreciate. What bothered me was, what was this rabbi thinking that made him assume that someone from my background would have any respect for this sort of blind observance, "We do it even if we don't understand it"? That's what bothered me. What was he thinking? What was his impression of who I was? Problem number one, why so much tekeim? Problem number two, why does that traditional community think that you have to speak in order to pray? And problem number three, what were they thinking that made them think that I would appreciate, "We do it even if we don't understand it"? Naseh v'nishma. Okay. Fast forward 10 years. 10 years later, I was in Jerusalem. This whole thing that I'm describing now took place in Los Angeles, which was my first stop in this traditional community. 10 years later, I was in Jerusalem. And I had the tremendous privilege of hearing a great Torah sage, one of the leaders of the Jerusalem community, speak. Elderly gentleman, long white beard, had studied from great sages in Europe, really was an emblem of the traditional community there. During this particular talk, there was about 150 people crowded into a room that was probably appropriate for about 50. And I had heard about the man, had no idea why so many people wanted to hear him. And when I heard what he said, I understood why they wanted to hear him, and I understood a lot more than that. I had a long list of problems with this man's community when I walked into the room that night. When I walked out of the room that night, all I had was utter respect. Because of one principle he introduced, which is the principle I came to speak about to you tonight, which is the lost art of love. This rabbi tried to make the case, and I should say he did it eloquently. He tried to make the case that every single aspect of Torah observance, every single aspect of the tales of the lies these traditional Jews led, was a training program for intimacy. And their whole goal was to create within themselves a certain potential which would allow intimacy spontaneously in a healthy, good way to happen in their lives. And when I say intimacy, I mean it with a capital I. I mean between husband and wife. I mean between parents and children. I mean in communal relations. Even between them and their God. That they believe it is possible for there to be total and absolute connection in this world. There doesn't have to be disconnection. There doesn't have to be loneliness. And they believe that every single aspect of Jewish tradition, and they claim it is the tradition they received from their fathers, 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 that the whole point of Judaism was to create real love and real connection in this world. To create a world where the lion would lay down with the lamb, and the lamb would even get some sleep. Yes, that is the goal, right, of Judaism according to them. It was a very long lecture with lots of detail, and I can't share most of it with you. What I will share is, now I've been doing various types of counseling, especially marriage counseling, although I do a lot of work with children these days as well, but especially marriage counseling for the last 10 years. And in my marriage counseling career, so early on, I noticed a certain pattern, which anyone who's been involved in marriage counseling, I'm sure, has seen as well. Or if you're just into the study of relationships, then you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. When couples come to me, unfortunately, most times the couples come to me with problems. They're coming to me because the marriage is on the rocks. They're either on the verge of a divorce or they're headed in that direction. When I start to dig to try to understand what went wrong, invariably, I never find that the relationship is breaking up because the couple differs over major issues.
She's a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I want a divorce.
That never happened. Yeah.
They forgot my 25th anniversary, I want out.
Right. That's not the way these relationships unravel. Never. What do the relationships unravel over? Okay. Now, I can say with absolute confidence, I've counseled at least two dozen couples, where the cause of the marital conflict was the temperature for the household thermostat. Should it be, right, 68 or 72? And I don't need to tell you who took which position. Yeah, right? And I'm telling you, at least two dozen couples I've dealt with who have been in that in a conflict over that. But I mean, a conflict that's tearing the marriage to pieces. I had a case where a couple came to speak to me, and they wanted a divorce, and I asked them why, and they both spontaneously said, because she hates me. So I thought, you know, what an interesting observation. They feel their spouse hates them. I said, what makes you think that your spouse hates you? So he said that when they got married, he mentioned to her that he can't stand crumbly toothpaste. And he says to me, she leaves the cap off on purpose. She knows that I hate that. She leaves it off on purpose. And she's saying, you know, like, no, you know, it's like, I just forget sometimes. You don't forget, you hate me. And he's persuaded that she hates him because of the crumbly toothpaste. So I turned to her and I said, why do you feel that he doesn't like you? So she says, at night, when he goes in to use the restroom, he leaves the seat up on purpose. I go in and I slip right in, he does it on purpose. Okay, now, this is a mature, otherwise apparently psychologically normal couple, and the sorts of things that they're getting a divorce over is crazy. I had two cases recently where the man wanted a divorce. It was the man who was pushing for a divorce. Now, in one case, I actually knew the man for several years before he came for counseling, so I can attest. He seemed like a psychologically healthy, normal person, right? And what did he want the divorce? In both cases, these two men, why did they want the divorce? In both cases, they both said to me, this latest case was, the fellow came to me and he said, I want to divorce my wife, and I just want to talk to you about it before I do it. Why are you divorcing her? He said, this is the last straw. He says, she doesn't like my beard, I'm going to divorce her. So he just starts to grow a beard. So I couldn't hold back. I said, give me a knife, I will cut your beard or your throat. You know, like, are you crazy? You know, like, insanity. He's going to divorce a perfectly wonderful woman because she doesn't like the beard. Yeah? The other guy told me the same thing. She didn't like the beard, he's going to divorce her. This is, and I we're talking about people who on the surface seem normal. And yet, over the stupidest, most itsy-bitty, picky-uny details, these people are getting divorced. And I start to notice that all marital conflict is over picky details. It's like a crazy thing. People feel loved or not loved depending on how much people notice the details in their life. Every now and then, a couple will come to me. It's rare, but it's wonderfully pleasant. A couple will come to me and they'll say, we'd like some marital tips. And I'll say, what's the problem? They say, no problem. We would just like to supercharge our marriage. What do you got? I had one couple. Yeah. I was counseling this couple. I have an office, but this couple came to my house. So they were sitting in my kitchen, and I have a sliding door that leads into my kitchen. So I knocked on the door, and then I opened the door. So they must not have heard me knock, because this couple was in the middle of expressing affection when I opened the door. Yeah. So I coughed, and that didn't deter them, so I walked out, closed the door, and came back a minute later, yeah. I walked in, I came around, I sat in front of them, and I said to them, is everything okay? And they said, yeah, everything's great. So I said to them, what are you here for? So they said, we're here for marriage counseling. So I said, like, you seem like you're doing just fine. So they said, we are doing fine, but we fear, you know, we're newly married and we want to make sure that our marriage goes well. So we came here to find out if there's anything that we should be concentrating on that we're not concentrating on now. So I said, you know, it actually seems to be going quite well. Maybe you can give me some advice, yeah? so So I said to them, I asked them a question because I had this other couple recently who said they felt that the spouses hated each other. I said to them, do you feel that your spouse loves you? And yeah. And she's like, oh yeah. So I said, why? What makes you think that your spouse loves you? So he answered, and he said that when he comes home from work at the end of the day, and he opens up the door, he said, very often, when his spouse looks up and sees that it's him opening the door, she gives him this big smile. That's how she knows. That's how he knows. He said, sometimes she'll make him a cup of tea. That's it. Yeah. So I said to her, like, he loves you. Oh, yeah. How do you know? She thought. She said, like, every now and then, he leaves me a note on the refrigerator. So I said, that's it? So she says the last one only had three words. That's what makes a great relationship, that he left a note on the refrigerator. Like, that's all the wisdom of being married. But she smiled at him when he opened the door. And what I started to realize is, all marriages, all relationships rise, or God forbid, fall, based on the details. Why? If you remember the 25th anniversary, that doesn't mean you love her. If you remember the 25th anniversary, right? So, okay, that's nice. If you don't remember the 25th anniversary, you should be shocked, yeah? But the fact, remember the 25th anniversary, that doesn't mean a lot. But if you remember that she likes flowers, and not just she likes flowers, but she likes the yellow roses with the lavender ribbon and the white poof stuff on the top, if you remember that, so that's significant. That means you really care when you start paying attention to the details. So it occurred to me in the last few years, if I was going to set up a self-help system to prepare people for intimacy and relationships, so I think what I would do is, I would include in this self-help program, like when I write the book, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to include in my self-help program a training system that will attune people, that will sensitize people to details. I think what I would do is I would give a list of like 100 or 200 details, 3, 4, 5, 613 details for people to practice attending to. Because the more that you become attuned to attending to detail, the more confident you are to be involved in a relationship. This rabbi with the long white beard explained to me, that's why there are 613 categories of Jewish law, with 15,000 subsections. Turns out to be one of the most comprehensive legal systems on the planet. Certainly among religions, it is the most comprehensive legal system. And the reason is because until a person becomes attuned to the small things, until I learn to sweat details, I'm not yet ready to be involved in an intimate relationship. That's the very beginning preparation. Why so many details? Because that's how relationships rise or fall. Why do you have to speak when you pray? That crazy law. What kind of a God do they believe in anyways? So the rabbi explained. Traditional Jewish sources understand that there are two kinds of speech that human beings are involved in. There's masculine speech and there's feminine speech. And although it's true that women engage in masculine speech as well, and men do engage in feminine speech, men are much more dominant when it comes to masculine speech, and women are much more dominant when it comes to feminine speech. What's the difference? The way these traditional rabbis explain it, they say like this. They say that men tend to speak when something needs to be accomplished. Excuse me, could you pass the ketchup, please? No, I'll pick out the trash. Who's paying the water bill? Okay, this is all classic masculine speech. Men tend to talk when something needs to be said. Now, that's a nice thing, because if something needs to be said, they will speak. One downside of this habit that men have of speaking when something needs to be said is that they tend not to speak when something does not need to be said. And therefore, the following scene can often transpire, right? The two will come home from work, and they'll be sharing the tales of their day. And she'll say, and then this happened, and this happened, and this happened. What do you think about that? And he'll say, oh. Right? And then she'll say, and the situation came up, but I wasn't sure if I should do this or I should, and I ended up doing this. What do you think about that? And he'll say, good. Yeah? You know, and after 20 minutes of this, she wants to grab him by the collar and say, talk to me! Yeah, you know, like, enough already. Let's have some communication. Okay. Masculine speech is speech that tends to accomplish physical things in this world. And although women do engage in masculine speech, men almost exclusively engage in masculine speech, with exceptions. Feminine speech is different. With feminine speech, what is accomplished is not necessarily in the physical realm. Over years, I've come to realize that women are more sensitive than men are, generally, with exceptions. Women are generally more sensitive to their position in what I call love space. That is, a woman is much more sensitive to whether or not she's drawing closer in a relationship or moving farther away. She can actually feel the most minor variations in the relationship. Much more sensitive generally than men. Because of that, women are aware that while it's nice when someone speaks to you, when you speak to somebody else, you actually draw close to them. And the more that you speak to them, the closer you draw. I have theories about why this might be. I think that speech might be one of the most intimate acts somebody can engage in because you're reaching into the deepest parts of who you are. You're pulling that up and you're sharing that. You end up giving the most precious gift that you own when you speak to somebody because it's your soul that you're pouring out. These traditional Jews have a line, words that leave the heart enter the heart. So when you speak, often what you're doing is you're sharing your heart. And when you give your heart to something, that's an act of extraordinary intimacy. One of these rabbis told me, the hottest spiritual organ in the entire human body, he had the point, where is the organ of intimacy in the human body? He said, it's right here. Because this is the place where you pour out what's in your heart. That's how you draw close to others. So while it's nice when someone speaks to me, when I speak to somebody else, that's when I actually draw close to them. Feminine speech is speech that creates relationship. It draws close. Because women are sensitive to the fact that when they speak to another, they're drawing close to that other person. Sometimes in a conversation, a woman will say things twice. Sometimes even three times in the conversation. And there's nothing wrong. It's 100% fine. They weren't trying to communicate information in the most terse fashion possible. They were trying to actually draw close to the person they were speaking to. Have you ever seen two women walking down the street and they're both talking simultaneously? Have you ever seen this phenomenon? Yes. There's nothing wrong here. This is perfectly normal. Why? Because what's happening is there's two people trying to get close to each other. And there's not necessarily importance in communication of information, yes? The point is they actually become close. Men also do this. Men are not as good at it, right? Men tend to be better at the functional. Women tend to be much better when it comes to the realm of relationship. And I believe that's because, again, they're much more sensitive to where they're holding a relationship. Are they drawing close or are they moving away? Within the Torah world, within the world of Judaism, there is something called masculine speech and something called feminine speech. What is masculine speech? According to these traditional Jews, masculine speech is when a person picks up an apple and says a blessing over it. Can I please have a bite of the apple, God? Borei pri ha'eis. When a person says a blessing over a piece of fruit, asking God for permission, may I eat this? That's functional. And therefore, that's masculine speech. When you're done eating the apple, thank you very much. Borei nefashos rabos. They say a blessing afterwards. Thank you. That's functional. Like kids say please and thank you. It gets them the piece of candy they want and keeps them in good relations with their parents. There is a kind of feminine speech within Judaism as well. Pure feminine speech. How did I discover this? This rabbi with a long white beard was giving a class to the heads of four yeshivas in Jerusalem on how to be a good husband. So I begged, as an academic observer, please allow me to watch the class. And the rabbi with the long white beard allowed me into the inner sanctum, and I actually sat while the heads of four yeshivas sat by this old man with long white beard, and he gave over to them a very traditional Jewish message about how to be a good husband, which it turns out I discovered over the three-year class, right? It was 3 years meeting once a week, each time for about 2 or 3 hours. It turns out being a good husband is almost as complicated as being a good wife. So, in his class, he said that if a couple does not spend intimate, private time at least twice a week, their marriage is headed for disaster. So, at this point, I'd already been in the class for about 18 months, and he was used to having me as this academic observer there, and I interrupted and I said, "What do you mean?" So, like, what do you mean, intimate, private time? So he looked at me like, jerk. But he said that besides, right, moments of physical intimacy, right, which he said should be actually the crescendo, it should be the zenith of the private time, but there should be hours of lead up where the couple just enjoys each other's company. And he described, I said, like, what do you mean? Like, how do you do that? I want to know, like, from your perspective, Rabbi, what does this look like? So I think he partially translated into modern terms for me, so that I would appreciate what he was talking about. But he said, for example, he said, what you should do is find a nice restaurant. He knew, I'm a professor at the University of North Texas. So he said, find a nice restaurant where you know there will be none of your students. He said, ask the maitre d' to give you a table in the back and ask him to set up candles on the table. He said, what you do is take your wife out for dinner. And he said, when you go out to dinner with her, sit next to her, right next to her. And he said, throughout the evening, you should whisper. So I said, why? So he said, because don't you feel what happens when we whisper? You know how small the room becomes. It's a very interesting thing. So I see that, like, everything he said made sense. It's all common sense. But he's not the common sense kind of guy. He's the traditional Jewish practice kind of guy. So I said to him, where did you get this? So he said, I got it from the code of Jewish law. So I said, are you telling me that somewhere in the code of Jewish law says you should take your wife out to a restaurant, have candles, and whisper with her? Like, what's going on? Yeah? So he says, yes. He says, it's right here. And he opens up to the beginning of the code of Jewish law. In the beginning of the code of Jewish law, there are the laws of prayer. So why are we looking here? So he says, look what it says right here. And he starts showing me the laws, the traditional laws of prayer. What does it say there? It says that three times a day, these traditional Jews do the following. First, they go out to a restaurant where there's no students. What does it mean? They take three steps back from the whole world. Okay, now, there's no one in the whole world. They've walked away from their daily lives, the grind, so to speak. Okay. Now, he said, sit next to your wife. Then they take three steps forward towards their beloved. Now they're standing right next to their beloved. And then they begin to whisper. And Jewish law is that when you pray, you don't scream like my neighbors in Jerusalem, right? The Arabs who live in Jerusalem who pray very, very loudly. Orthodox Jews don't do that. They don't pray silently like my Christian neighbors. Rather, they whisper. To explain why. Because this is pure feminine speech. And the whole goal is to draw close. His words to me were, how loud would you speak if you knew that her ear was right next to your mouth? Why do you have to speak? The reason these traditional Jews believe we have to speak is not because God doesn't know what's in my heart. Of course God knows what's in my heart. We're talking about the omnipotent, almighty, omniscient one. Of course he knows what's in my heart. Why do I have to speak? I've got to speak because he's already 10,000% in love with me. And he wants me to join him in that relationship. And the way that you fall in love is by reaching inside and give you something very, 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 very precious. And the more you speak, the more you love. If a woman who had ESP, she could read her husband's mind, was married. And because she could read her husband's mind, her husband never had to speak to her. He could think and she would immediately know what he was thinking. But she always had to speak to him in order to express what was on her mind because he didn't have ESP. In such a relationship, what would end up happening would be that the woman would fall very deeply in love with her husband because she would be sharing with him all the time. She would be speaking, she'd be reaching in and actually saying the words. And the man would end up getting left out of the relationships. And I think this is part of the reason why women get so concerned when they speak to their husbands and their husbands don't speak back. Because the woman who is very sensitive to her position in love space realizes, he's not drawing close to me. It's an intuitive feeling. I don't believe it's cognitive. But at an intuitive level, we feel that if someone's not speaking to us, they're not drawing close to us. And that's the reality. If we don't speak, we don't draw close. And therefore, the traditional Jews say, anyone you ever want to draw close to, you must speak to, you must open up, you must pour out the words. Why do they speak? Because they think that's the only way to achieve intimacy. Why so much detail? Because that's what relationships rise or fall based on. But what about this crazy thing? These traditional Jews who say, Na'ase v'nishma, we'll do it even if we don't understand it. What are they thinking? I mean, this is absolute fanaticism, blind faith, a long dive into an empty pool. I was giving a college course in relationships. And I was lecturing in this particular session on a certain problem that comes up very, very often in relationships where people will not accommodate each other if they don't understand why the other person has this particular request. If it can't be rationally justified, then one spouse will not accommodate the other. And it's a tremendous source of tension in many marriages, many relationships. When I was in the middle of speaking about how we should accommodate our spouses even if they can't rationally justify their position, the secretary at a college walked in and she handed me a note. The note indicated that my wife had left an urgent message. And I read the message. The message was, sweetie, on your way home from work today, could you please pick up 2 packages of seaweed? So while I was trying to figure out why my wife wanted seaweed, I crumpled the note up, tucked it in my pocket, completed the lesson about attending to your spouse's wishes even when they're irrational, and then when I completed the lecture, walked into my office, packed up my bags, and was walking out of the building. As I was walking out of the building, I started to fantasize, and I started to imagine, what would it look like if a man who did not understand how relationships worked received such a note? What would his response be? So I can imagine a husband getting such a note, and thinking like, what does she want seaweed for? Running to the phone, dialing. No answer! What a chutzpah! She asked for seaweed, she won't tell me why. I'm not going to get it for her! Slam! Like, I can imagine such a thing. What happened? So, I walked out of the building, and I walked down to the Israeli makolet. If you've never experienced an Israeli makolet, it's sort of like a 7-Eleven run by a gangster. Yeah? And I made the mistake of requesting seaweed, at which point he said something like, in Hebrew, you're the son of the dog! You know, like, you know, which I think in Israeli is not a nice thing. And at that point he told me that I should go to a health food store. So I walked out, right, and I got on the bus. Okay, now, to appreciate the bus ride that I had immediately after that, you have to understand a little bit about the background of my family. My wife is the youngest of 4 children. And when my father-in-law was raising his firstborn son, my wife's oldest brother, he was looking for something healthy that he could immerse all the kids in. So he found this wonderful thing in Los Angeles called Boy Scouts. And he enrolled my oldest brother-in-law in Boy Scouts, and it's fantastic, and it's healthy, and it's wholesome, and it's beautiful. And it really was a wonderful program. And my father-in-law loved it, and my brother-in-law loved it, and my father-in-law ended up becoming the Boy Scout troop leader. When the next boy, the next oldest is also a boy, when he was ready, my father-in-law enrolled him in Boy Scouting as well. And by then, my father-in-law had actually become the head of all of Boy Scouts in Los Angeles. When the third boy was ready, my father enrolled him in Boy Scouting as well. By this time, the oldest had become an Eagle Scout already. And when the third was enrolled in Boy Scouting, my father had become head of Boy Scouting in California. When my wife was of age, so my father-in-law enrolled her in Girl Scouts, where they sell cookies. And she said, I'm going to use the Hebrew, she said, ze lo fair, yeah? You know, like, what are you doing? Like, you know, they're going on these cross-country European bike tours, and I'm selling Girl Scout cookies, you know? So she begged and pleaded, and my father-in-law said, okay, if you promise not to tell anybody, put on a t-shirt and a baseball cap, right, and you can come with us, we'll pretend you're a Boy Scout. So my wife ended up becoming a Boy Scout. And she went through the whole thing. She was Eagle Scout. She did the wilderness training. You can take my wife. You can dump her in a forest with a pocket knife. She'll survive for 2 weeks. So I discovered there are advantages and disadvantages in marrying a Boy Scout. Yeah? So an advantage of marrying a Boy Scout, right, is that, you know, like, she really didn't need very much. When I married my wife, at the time I had a very successful business running. I was in the sound lighting business. And I had money. And I would say to my wife, I would say to her, you know, like, I love you. I want to buy you something. What do you want? Do you want jewelry? Do you want perfume? Do you want, you know, clothing? Tell me what you want. I want to buy you something. And it would frustrate me because she would always say, no, I just want to be with you. Yeah. You know, I'm like, no, I want to buy you something that she really didn't need because she was a Boy Scout. Yeah. Okay. So one of the advantages of marrying a Boy Scout is they don't need very much. But one of the disadvantages of marrying a Boy Scout is they don't need very much. Okay. Now, over the years, I've discovered certain things that make my wife giggle. There are certain things that she really, really likes a lot. I have a very, 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 very small but precious list of physical things that I can give her that she really likes. And that list is very, 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 very precious to me because I love her to pieces and all I want to do is really gift her and take care of her. There's things on that list. She likes yellow roses with the lavender ribbon and the white poof stuff, which she always tries to tell me what it's called, but I always forget. Yeah, she likes that stuff. She loves carob. I don't know why. She loves carob. Yeah. There's certain things that just make her giggle. That day, when I got on the bus to head into town, going into downtown Jerusalem, to pick up for her a couple of bags of seaweed, I had no clue why she wanted seaweed. But I was thrilled. Because I had something new on my list. I was going to get Hannah seaweed. Wow! Okay, I arrived at the health food store, walked in, I said, do you have any seaweed? And the man said to me, oh. So I said, what's on? He said, we just sold our last bag. At which point I said, oh. So he thought I was disturbed. So he said, don't worry. He says, just a minute walking there, there's another health food store. He says, I'm sure they have. They always have seaweed. So I said, would you call first? So he called over to the other health food store, and they had seaweed. So I said, could you please tell him to put a guy aside a couple of bags for me? So he told man, there's a fellow coming over who looks like he badly needs a couple of bags. Could you put them aside? Yeah. So he put aside a couple of bags of seaweed for me. Okay, so I sprinted across Jerusalem to this other place, right? Ran in panting. I walked up to the guy and said, I'm the man for the seaweed. He says, no problem. Pulls out from behind the counter two bags of seaweed, puts it on the counter. So he says, do you want anything else? So I'm looking at the man, bags of seaweed, and right next to the bags of seaweed are all these boxes of carob bars. So I reach in, I pull out a couple of each type of carob bar, and I put them on the counter, I said, I'll take these as well. Anything else? No, that's it. Wraps up the whole thing, puts it in a bag, hands it to me. I walk out of the health food store. I walk around the corner, I'm heading back up to the bus. So I'm heading back up to the bus, I pass the flower store. I walk back. I go into the flower store. I say, can I please have the yellow roses, lavender ribbon, poof stuff. I explain what that is. Yeah? Fine. He gives me the whole package. I get back on the bus. I head home. I get home, knock on the door. Hannah opens the door, and I say, hi. Now, why did I do that? I had no idea why she wanted seaweed. And of course, the reason I did it was That's what it is when you're in love. Now, it's not that you don't care why she wants the seaweed. I would like to crawl around inside of Hannah's head and discover every detail of what she likes and why. Because when you love somebody, you want to know all the whys. But I'm not going to refuse to cooperate until I get the whys. Because I'm involved in a relationship. I'm in love. And when you're in love, that's how you behave. And I realized 10 years after the fact, that's what this rabbi was trying to explain to me. What he was saying to me was, Lane, I know you're an academic, but even though you're an academic, you're still a human being. I mean, you love your wife? That's what he was saying to me, is that even though I'm intellectual, I'm capable of being involved in intimacy. And the backbone of intimacy is, we do it for her, even if we don't understand why. Why? Because it's not a religion. We're involved in a relationship. The whole system is a training system for falling in love. Now, obviously, it's a much longer story. I'm not going to go into all the details tonight. It turns out that over the next 12 years, walking in with this perspective, what I discovered is that every single mitzvah, every single aspect of this great tradition which our ancestors handed down to us, every aspect of what we stand for, what the Jewish community stands for, is really intimacy. We came here to create a world of intimacy, in the words of this rabbi, an Olam of Yidid is a world of intimacy, of connection. You open up a newspaper today, you see the world very badly needs the gift that we have to give. We live in a world of total disconnection, of estrangement, of distrust, of isolation. And the stuff that you see in the newspaper is just the international hints of what's really taking place on the interpersonal level. And I can attest to you, because I do counseling all over the world, that what's going on in Philadelphia is exactly what's going on in LA and Baltimore, which is exactly what's going on throughout Europe and South Africa. I've been in Brazil, I was just in Mexico. All over the world, it's the same thing at the interpersonal level, and you just see it played out big time in the headlines in the newspapers. We live in a world of disconnection right now, but it's not supposed to be that way. We, the Jewish people, came to this planet to remind people how to practice the lost art of love. Thank you.
That concludes our presentation of Ancient Wisdom for Modern Minds by Lawrence Kellerman. For more tapes by Lawrence Kellerman, visit www.lawrencekellerman.com. That's www.lawrencekellerman.com.